Golf Today.
Welcome into Golf Today. I'm Eamon Lynch alongside Ryan Lavner. It is only July 1st, but if you're a professional golfer, starting to get late early in the PGA Tour season, particularly if you're on the bubble for top 70 for the playoffs or keeping your tour card.
It's a little wild. There's only 5 weeks left in the regular season. One of those weeks, obviously, occupied by a major championship. There's some big names who are currently outside that number. Max Homa, Sahith Theegala. Both of those two players have lifelines for the next couple years in the PGA Tour. Not so for the rank and file. For them, it's going to be put up or shut up time.
It really is the last chance saloon. And the PGA Tour is in the heartland for the John Deere Classic in Silvis, Illinois. TPC Deer Run began hosting this event in 2000. Because there was no event in 2020, this is the 25th playing of the tournament at this venue. But Davis Thompson is looking to become the first back-to-back winner of the John Deere Classic since Steve Stricker won three in a row from 2009 through 2011. Last year, Thompson set a tournament record when he finished at 28 under par. Now, Haley Hunter is on site at TPC Deer Run for us this week. And Haley, you have more on what it takes to succeed at this familiar venue.
Hey, thanks, Eamon. You know, it's always a type of tournament out here where you're going to see some really low numbers, but that's also what makes it so much fun to watch this golf tournament. As last year, the John Deere Classic saw 2,055 birdies out here, which was more than any other event on the PGA Tour in 2024. In fact, the tournament here last year had the second most birdies on the PGA Tour. The CJ Cup, Byron Nelson, still had 75 less birdies. So players know coming into TPC Deer Run that they are going to have to put up some low numbers out here. 12 of the last 15 years, we've seen that winning total at least 20 under par. And as you just mentioned, Davis Thompson, the winner here last year, really setting that bar extra high with his 28 under final total on Sunday, which of course is now the tournament scoring record. And with that, the reason he found so much success is he was really good with his wedges, dialing those wedges into the greens and giving himself a lot of birdie opportunities. You're going to see players about half of their approach shots out here this week coming from within about 150 yards and in. So a lot of wedges out here, and that makes you wonder who's good from that distance. If you take a look at the best wedge players on the PGA Tour right now from 50 to 125 yards out, you'll see names such as Jackson Suber, who ranks second on tour from that distance. He just finished tied for sixth at the Rocket Classic last week. Paul Peterson ranks third along with Doug Ginn, Max McGreevy, and Emiliano Grillo. Meanwhile, some of the best putters out here this week, that's going to be really important. Sam Ryder, Brant Snedeker, Nico Echeverria, and Jacob Bridgman, who's also specifically one of the best putters from 10 to 20 feet, which we're really going to see a lot of this week. And earlier, I made my way out to the course to check in with some of these players on how they plan to best manage a very scoreable course like this one that certainly rewards those really good wedge hitters as well as that good putting.
Yeah, it's a little bit more position golf this week for sure. So I think it's more of a, you know, give yourself as many chances at birdie as you can. So it's a lot more just get it in the fairway and then let your, you know, short irons do the work.
I think the key out here is getting yourself as many birdie looks as possible. Guys are going to be going low, so keeping yourself in the fairway is huge. Gives you a better opportunity to get it close onto some of these bigger greens. So that's kind of the big key out here is being in the fairway.
Not one of the longer courses, too. How often do you plan to use driver off the tee out here?
Actually, a pretty decent amount. I think the, you know, the further you can get it up and give yourself shorter clubs into the greens, the better off you are. There's not a ton of trouble off the tee, but if you're in the rough, it's tough. But further up you are, if you're hitting through or driver, then it's more of an advantage for sure.
There's a couple three woods and hybrids off some tees. Call it 14 tee shots. I'd probably say there's, you know, nine or 10 drivers, and then, you know, a couple mix of three woods and hybrids on some holes. So yeah, I mean, driving it is important out here. It's, you can attack a lot of the, it's a place where scores tend to be low. You can still somewhat play from the rough, but to really be attacking and shooting some scores, you got to drive it in the fairway.
And lastly, just how important are those wedges out here? It looks like you guys are going to have a lot of those shots from 150 and in.
Yeah, I haven't been on the course yet. I'm going out here shortly, so I haven't seen the firmness of the greens, but wedges are all, you know, this course presents a lot of opportunities with some short clubs. And so, yeah, you definitely got to take advantage when you get those wedges in your hands. Even when they tuck the pins out here, guys seem to find ways to make birdies with those scoring clubs. So driving it in the fairway and then, you know, taking advantage with the short clubs is definitely key.
It's definitely a scoreable course. You got to drive it relatively straight, but yeah, it's all about scoring, you know, hitting your short irons well, wedges well, and then Putting is a big thing here too.
Is short game a challenge around the greens as well? I remember you guys a couple years ago when I was here saying the rough can get pretty thick there if you leave yourself short.
Yeah, it's a little bit spotty, so there's some thick areas and some thinner areas, but really you just don't want to short side yourself. So you kind of want to, you know, because there are so many birdies and low scores, you really don't want to make too many bogeys. So you want to give yourself an opportunity to get it up and down when you can.
We just heard the players talk about how thick the rough can get out here. It's certainly no Oakmont rough, but they do have it grown out to about 4 inches, which they'll plan to have going into the weekend. And some of the rough around the green is really where we've heard players in the past struggle a little bit. We just heard some of the players talk about the importance of not short-siding yourself, and that is because some of that rough in and around the greens is a little more challenging. That is what they're trying to challenge players with the most out here, considering how scoreable the course is overall in the other areas as well, guys.
Well, Haley, John Deere is the 30th event of the regular season, just 5 weeks remaining until the start of the playoffs. Among the notable players in the field on that top 70 bubble, last week's playoff loser, Chris Kirk, Davis Thompson, the defending champion, Ricky Fowler, Carl Phillips. Understand, Haley, that you had an opportunity to catch up with one of those bubble players earlier today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Talk with Ricky Fowler just a little bit ago. This is such a crucial week for so many of those players that are right on that top 70 playoff bubble right now, as the majority of this 156-player field, those players aren't in the top 70. So a really critical week for those guys. And talking with Ricky earlier, we talked about the fact that there's only three full-point U.S. events left going into those playoffs. So he knows this is a really important week for him. And this is what he had to say about his mindset coming into the John Deere Classic, which he last played all the way back in 2010.
Just need to execute and play some good golf. You know, this is a place we haven't been at in a long time and excited to be back here. I feel like there's been a lot of good stuff with my game as of late. Obviously last week wasn't anything special, but I know there's good finishes right around the corner. So yeah, we'll see if we can get a few good weeks and put ourselves in a good spot for August and postseason.
I know the first and the last time I believe that you were here was back in 2010. So from what you heard about this course and what you remember, what do you feel the part of your game needs to be brought to the next level to have success out here?
I feel like there's enough room out here. There's a couple tough or good driving holes, but yeah, I think for me, driving the ball well and put myself in position where I can go ahead and play, you know, offense or aggressively from there will definitely help. So I think that's first and foremost, kind of get the ball in play, and hopefully everything kind of, you know, can feed off of that.
What parts of your game do you feel like are trending in the right direction where you want to be right now?
I feel like a little bit of everything. Okay. Like putting's been here and there, some good days, some off days. I kind of can say that with just about everything, but yeah. No, it's been good to see that at least everything can work. It's still there, so just trying to stay patient and build some confidence and momentum.
Is there a little bit of extra pressure considering there's just three U.S. events that are full points left leading into the playoffs, or are you just kind of trying to treat this like any other week out here?
I mean, we know the time frame, know where we're at in the season, but good golf solves a lot of things. So, you know, looking forward to this week and then going over the pond for the British and being at, you know, Port Rush, and then we'll kind of figure out in the next couple of weeks what the plan will be post British, because obviously you want to be in the playoffs, but you also want to be fresh and ready to go play. Sure. But if we need to play leading in, then we're going to play.
Of the 30 players that are ranked between 60th and 90th in the FedEx Cup standings right now, 20 of those 30 players are here at the John Deere Classic this week. So when it comes to those standings moving up and down, we're likely going to see a lot of that here this week. It's a big opportunity for a lot of those playoff bubble players, including Ricky Fowler. And important to keep in mind that 24 of the last 53 winners here at the John Deere Classic have been first-time winners. So we may just see somebody win for the first time on the PGA Tour and with that move themselves up 30 to 35 or so spots and take somebody else's spot in that top 70 playoff bubble, guys.
Every opportunity counts for a lot these days. Thanks, Haley.
Ryan, on Ricky Fowler, sort of an enigma these days, because if you go back to, we talk a lot about his ball striking and how that's been an issue, but you know, this is a guy who led the PGA Tour in putting 2017. He's 100th now. He had a top 15 short game for most of the early part of his career. He's outside the top 130 now. He's making a lot of cuts, but two top tens in 40-odd starts since he won in Detroit a couple of years ago. That's a lot of cuts, but not a lot of progress.
I think when you hear Ricky sort of diagnosing what's going on with his game currently, one thing he didn't mention in particular was his approach play. Keep in mind, just 2 years ago, he was the seventh best iron player on the PGA Tour. It's really hard to be competitive on today's PGA Tour without an elite iron play. I think a perfect example is what happened last week with Rocket Classic winner Aldrich Potgieter, missing a boatload of cuts, one of the worst iron players on the PGA Tour. What happens? He makes an equipment tweak. All of a sudden, he has his best iron performance of the year in Detroit, and now he's the first-time PGA Tour winner. Ricky Fowler is outside the top 100 in strokes gained approach. You do not see any elite player in that sort of vicinity. So while he's seeing upticks in his driving, certainly seeing upticks with his putting, that's really the main part of his game. It's holding him back. And as you just heard in Haley's report, that's going to be such a premium on knocking down flags this week.
And he doesn't really have a huge weapon these days. 36 years old. Has he aged out of the phenom category? Is it likely that Ricky Fowler's best days are behind him rather than ahead of him?
It's possible. I still think it's possible for him to play steady, consistent golf, still be a top 50 player on the PGA Tour. Again, we're just 2 years removed from him being an elite player on the PGA Tour statistically and also being a champion. But there's certain aspects of his game that he has to clean up if he wants to get back to the upper echelon.
And still one of the most popular players in the game. And speaking of popular people in this game, we're going to scooch over on the set a little bit here. We're going to make room for our next guest, Joel Beagle. He's a writer at Golf Digest and the author of a terrific new book. We're going to talk about that coming up. Welcome back to Golf Today. Joel Beagle is one of the finest writers covering this game today. He's a senior writer for Golf Digest and has a new book. It's called Playing Dirty, Rediscovering Golf's Soul in Scotland in an Age of Sportswashing and Civil War. And it details his attempt to find a little relief from the division and greed that has come to define this game in the last few years. And it's good to have Joel here with us in the studio. Joel, why Scotland and why so disaffected with golf? Were you just not persuaded by all of these guys who told you that they were going to grow the game?
Right. Thanks for having me and thanks for dressing up, Wav. Appreciate it. I guess it must be gap day for you. But the last couple of years, I felt like it deserved some type of forensic accounting, what was going on. But I also didn't want to just take a flamethrower to it. I thought, let's be surgical. How do we really show the ridiculousness of the past couple of years? And to me, Scotland is the purest form of golf. And using that prism to kind of show, yeah, this has been absurd, but here's kind of where the real soul of golf lies. I felt like it kind of gave an answer to these existential questions we've been asking, and giving us hope too that what we're kind of seeing right now is ephemeral and ultimately this is just a storm that's going to pass.
So where did your reporting take you? How long did you spend in Scotland and how long did it take you to work on the book?
Yeah, I spent the summer in Scotland last year. My wife was a trooper, came with me. I told her, listen, the weather is not as bad as you think, and it turned out to be the wettest summer in like 15 years in Scotland. So God bless her for that. But there's been a lot of books covering going to Scotland to find themselves, and I didn't want to do your normal eat, pray, love of my version of it. So instead, I wanted to put the focus on the towns, the people, and the places that make Scottish golf what it is. And I tried to go off the beaten path of things I've already been covered. And, you know, yes, it took me to St. Andrews, but it took me to little towns outside of it. Went up north to the Scottish Highlands, spent some time down North Berwick, went west to Campbelltown. And through that journey, just found some fantastic people that really kind of not only embody what I think golf is, but were the antithesis of some of the nonsense we've seen in the professional game the past few years.
What if golfers in Scotland that you met, whether it was on the golf course or in the bars and restaurants, actually make of the division? Because certainly in Europe, Saudi Arabian money isn't perceived as being as dirty as it is in the United States because of the September 11th connection. But did golfers in Scotland have a consistent view on that issue in your mind, or is it just so removed from how they actually view the game or their experience with the game?
Yeah, and that, you know, I went in thinking this would be a little more normalized because, as you mentioned, you know, the Saudi Arabian money is viewed differently, and it's also already been around the sports world, right, with Premier League, F1, soccer. And yet, almost to a person, especially in Scotland, they are very much against what they've seen happen since 2022. And a lot of that is they're very in tune with the havoc that Livera has wrecked on the sport. And to them, yeah, they can wrap their head around the monetary, the financial reasons why these guys are jumping. They can't get behind all the damage it's done to the sport they love so much. And even though there is a division between their golf and the professional game, they still see the collateral damage that the LIV PGA Tour battle is causing. And to them, you know, they just can't understand why, especially guys in their prime, would associate themselves with this unserious product.
Is that just that their traditions are being messed with as fans? Or do you think it is an objection to just the conversation about money all the time and that being the motivator?
I think it's the latter, especially when you, one of the reasons I think we love Scottish golf so much, it's the democratic game. You know, in America, it's so much of an aspirational sport where you have to have some money to play and have access to it. Over there, it's no matter who you are, no matter what age you are, you have a way into the sport. And it just dominates and permeates everything around Scottish life. So to see this barrier kind of put in place to a game they love, I think that's where a lot of their argument comes from.
Joel, a year later, what sort of scenes or memories still resonate with you through the course of your reporting?
Yeah, the two that really stick out are meeting this man named Robert Strang, who is a caretaker at a place called Nine Holer called Caradale, which is about 40 minutes north of Makarhanish for those who made the pilgrimage down there. And a man who's been taking care of this course his entire life, someone who is a hero in his community. He's been the mayor. He's captain of the local fire department. Someone who takes care of this course all by himself and someone who's gave himself so selflessly for this town of 400 people, which contrasted that against some of the, you know, more ego and greed we've seen here. I thought it was just a great juxtaposition. And this is the guy who could do anything he wants with his life. He's a smart guy. Everyone speaks to him well, but he's devoted his life to making this course better and making it as good as it can be for his town. And just that devotion really, really spoke to me.
What does Scottish golf have that golf elsewhere, particularly in the United States, doesn't have or has lost?
I think the idea of, this is going to sound so simple, but just decoupling yourself from score and just focusing on enjoyment. When you ask someone how their round went, no one tells you score or a good shot, bad shot. They just talk about the camaraderie they had with somebody. They talk about, did they play fast? They just talk about the experience. And I think that's where a lot of their joy comes from, is just the appreciation for getting the opportunity to play. And I think, unfortunately, over here, we focus so much on results or we focus on the wrong things. And over there, just the idea that, man, how lucky are we just to play this great game is something that really resonates throughout the entire country.
Joel, this was your first book. I'm curious, after a year sort of, you know, in devoting yourself to it, how has that experience in your reporting and your writing sort of shadowed how you are now covering the game and the PGA Tour at the highest level?
I've tried to bring a little bit of that joy I saw in Scotland back to the game, because especially the past couple of years, it's been a slog, right? It's not exactly fun to be covering what's going on at the top level, not only just on the LIV side, but we've seen so many central actors on the tour side really take care of themselves rather than worry about where their actions were taking the hole. And I think you've seen that kind of come down to us as media. It's hard to kind of keep a bright perspective on things. And yet, being in Scotland and seeing that what truly matters, it's really helped me find the love and the joy again, what we do. Even just a couple weeks ago at Oakmont, watching JJ Spahn, yes, that putt was fantastic, but seeing his reaction and celebrating with his family, that kind of really stuck to me what really matters. And that's just something I saw a parallel within Scotland that I try to take back here.
In the book, you also delve into Donald Trump's complicated relationship with Scottish golf, including the controversy over building his first course there in Aberdeen. It's been reported that he's tried to pressure the British government, to pressure the RNA to bring the Open back to Turnberry, which it hasn't been there since he bought it a decade ago. Do you see the Open going back there while Donald Trump's name is above the door?
Not as long as he's alive, at least. I think we had the stereotype of the RNA being this conservative bunch, and I think that stereotype rings true. This is a group also that does not like to be bossed around and told what to do. Part of the issue stems from they don't necessarily like the way he's done business. They're very aware of what he's done in Scotland. But more importantly, going back to the 2015 Women's Open that was held at Turnberry, they saw that tournament became about the owner, not the players. And until the focus returns to the course and the championship, I don't think you're going to see at least a men's open at Turnberry anytime soon.
Joel, what do you see as the final outcome of golf civil war?
That's a loaded question.
Yeah, right. I do think ultimately we will see the PGA Tour side and PIF come together. Right now, the tour feels like they have all the cards, but I think there's still two wild cards out there, and that is one, this idea that LIV could ultimately get world ranking points. I think those discussions aren't as far along as they've been reported, but they are happening. The second is, you know, if the PGA Tour PIF deal doesn't come to fruition, I think the tour is very aware that PIF could turn around and go to the DP World Tour. That's who they originally tried to go to. And suddenly you have new leadership in the DP World Tour who's maybe doesn't have the same aversion to the Saudi money as the previous leadership did. Also very aware that his players realize, well, wait a minute, why did we turn away this money that all of a sudden went to our American counterparts? I think the tour understands that's out there, and whatever distaste they may have for parting with the Saudis, watching that money go somewhere else and turning an ally into a potential competitor, I think is something they're very, very well aware of.
Definitely a story that's going to roll on for some time to come. You might have another book to write on this before it's all done. But congratulations, Joel. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys, for having me. Appreciate it.
And here's one more look at Joel's book out now, Playing Dirty, Rediscovering Golf Soul in Scotland in an Age of Sportswashing and Civil War.
And stay with us when Golf Today returns. We head back to the Midwest in this week's Tour Stop. John Deere Classic Tournament Director Andrew Lehman joins us. Plus, take a walk down memory lane and look back at some of the most notable champions at this event.